Southern Foodways Alliance work wouldn't be possible without generous donors. Today we thank Maker's Mark, a family-owned distillery in Loretto, Kentucky, that still rotates barrels by hand and dips each bottle of bourbon in their signature red wax. It's the perfect bourbon for sipping on your porch in the cool of the evening. We're also grateful to longtime friends Lodge Cast Iron, a family-owned foundry in South Pittsburgh, Tennessee. From Camp Dutch ovens to cast iron skillets and grill pans, Lodge makes the cookware that you need for your socially distanced dinner parties and camping vacations.
I'm John T. Edge.
And I'm Melissa Hall. We're your hosts for Gravy.
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 A production of the Southern Foodways Alliance, Gravy tells new and complicated stories about the changing American South.
Amy Nezakumatatil is the author of four previous poetry collections, including Oceanic. She has been published in the Best American Poetry Series, New York Times Magazine, and just recently, the fall issue of Gravy.
The National Endowment for the Arts honored her with a poetry prize, and she received a pushcart prize, too. She's also a 2020 Guggenheim Fellow.
She's on a roll. I also have the pleasure of working across campus from Amy. She's a professor of English and creative writing in the University of Mississippi MFA program.
Her brand new book, A Sumptuous Collection of Illustrated Nature Essays from Milkweed Editions, is World of Wonders, in praise of fireflies, whale sharks, and other astonishments. John T. talked with Amy about how a closer look at nature can help shape a better future for the South. They went deep on corpse flowers, too.
Corpse flowers and courtship. You'll hear it. Listen for it. This book offers us a novel way to regard the natural world. This book integrates everyday life and family history and natural history. World of Wonders offers a path, a prompt to see and think anew. And I'm deeply appreciative of the opportunity to talk with you today, Amy. Thank you.
Yes, I'm so happy to be here. It just feels like it's 180 because I wrote the bulk of these essays. It's my first book that I wrote the bulk of it and edited everything right here in Oxford. So everything else that I've written up to this point was all over the country, but this is the one, the most Oxford of all the books.
Well, you know, and here we are separated by a mile or two and a pandemic.
Exactly.
You know, and it seems to me that this moment of the pandemic, you know, I think about all the fictitious stories about nature is returning. But I do think about this moment in the way that we are turning our attention to nature in new ways. And I do think about your book as a pathway to that. I mean, am I reading too much in that, or is that part of your intent as you think about the way your book will land in this moment?
Yeah, you know, I mean, of course, no one could have ever predicted this kind of situation, but I do actually have, you know, a lot of times people say, oh, I'm so sorry, you're releasing a book in a pandemic. But then once they actually read it, they come back to me and say, oh, Amy, it was just the thing, you know, I needed to feel good about something again. And they're short little bits. So, you know, many people say they're having a hard time concentrating. So these essays are short, illustrated essays. And I'm hoping that while we pay more attention to maybe what's right in front of us, our garden, or a new way of just looking at the trees a little bit more closely when we take our evening walks or something, I'm hoping that a little bit of that enthusiasm and a little bit of re-looking at the world serves as a reminder that really what's around us is possibly some of the most wondrous plants and animals we can find.
And you know, you don't anthropomorphize your subjects, and yet you do set your subjects in motion across the field of vision in the field of for a reader. And I think about the way you describe the catalpa trees as protectors and the leaves with spit curls, not unlike a naughty boy from a 50s movie whose first drag race ends in defeat and spill milkshakes. Like, I love that so much because you are not rendering a flat landscape. You are rendering a landscape of great texture, alive with plants and animals that pull me forward. And I just admire that so much.
Thank you so much. And, you know, it's funny. I chose plants and animals that people would maybe be familiar with. I know here in Mississippi, I mean, right here at the University of Mississippi, we have the champion catalpa, which is the tallest catalpa in the state of Mississippi. And a lot of my students who'd been here, who'd been born here, they didn't know that. They've been walking past it. It's just right outside the student union. And they never stopped to look at the little marker that mentions it, you know. So I made sure to put that as a wonder, but also something maybe that they hadn't seen in person, like a narwhal or an axolotl, you know. But then there's also things hopefully that people will see that recognize, like a firefly, you know, a monarch butterfly. So I did that very purposely so that people don't feel, you know, intimidated with like, oh, I haven't traveled around the world. I don't know these plants or animals. Again, I just wanted to reiterate that there's so much wonder right before our eyes. And then there's also so much more out there too. so that it doesn't take someone to have traveled extensively or, you know, to be super worldly, but it hopefully provides a training ground, a retraining to get our eye to appreciate a little bit more what's around us.
One of the things that I took away from this book is that you leverage your family history to introduce us to the subjects of your book. And you beautifully do that with a passage about your mother and your family and about fireflies. And it reminded me of a poem I read by Ada Limon, where she refers to fireflies as field bling. And it makes me ask, like, are poets especially drawn to fireflies? What is there for you there? Yeah,
it seems like it. I mean, I think it's a natural subject in some ways because, and I am a big fan of Ada Limon's poetry. But I think there's something so magical about fireflies. And I don't want to speak for Ada, but for me, it takes me back to childhood and those times and those days that just felt so long in the best ways, you know. Where, I mean, honestly, it sounds ridiculous, but I could spend hours just kind of standing around in the driveway trying to catch fireflies and not even a minute be bored, you know. And my parents, and, you know, we didn't have this stuff growing up, but my parents made sure that we were never beholden to electricity or anything with batteries for entertainment, you know. And it's something that I try to instill now with my own children, you know, to find their entertainment or to be able to be at peace without, oh, what's next on the news or what's next on this next video game or, you know, that kind of thing. So I think in some ways it's a reminder of simple fun and entertainment as a kid, you know, and those long, slow days. I don't know, you know, it was just such a magical time for me.
And, you know, I use that word simplistic. One of the things I'm struck by is the ways in which you take this mass of knowledge that you acquired in writing this book and synthesize it in a way that is certainly not simplistic, but it is approachable. And, you know, in your book, trees talk to each other and plants have a temperature and connect to fungal networks. As you approach that, as you approach this kind of synthesizing of knowledge, what was your watchword? What were you trying to do in that kind of synthesization work?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, you know, Annie Dillard said, the more we get to know about the planet and its inhabitants, the more, I think I'm butchering the quote a little bit, but to paraphrase, she says, the more we get to know about the planet and its inhabitants, the less appetite we have for destruction. And I think that's so true. Like the more we get to know about thinking of the way certain birds and amphibians look to the stars to find their way home, how could you not want to protect them? You know, you get to know a little bit about them. And I think the same is for other cultures. Once you get to know another culture, you don't fear them so much. You don't want to destroy them. It's not easy to destroy a land or a part of a forest once you know, oh, all these creatures that you know so much about live in that forest, you know? So, and what is that phrase? I think it's a Southern phrase. You catch more flies with honey, you know? I didn't want this to be very polemic or, mm-hmm. you know, gloom and doom, like you must do this or you must recycle or these butterflies will die or whatever, you know, but rather look at the beauty and the marvelousness of these creatures and plants. And then I have to bet on it that humans might take another pause before they choose to use Roundup in their yard or before they toss that can into the street, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm hoping that they at least pause or reconsider their relationship and realize that we're all connected, and that's to plants too. And the trees can help connect us as well. So that's my hope.
That strikes me as a kind of forward looking stance, and that, you know, fits well with our overall theme this year, that we're focused on the future of the South. You know, what, you know, certainly climate change is a future tense and present tense problem we must address. But setting that aside for a moment, what future can we better apprehend by way of paying attention to the plants and animals that populate your book?
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, that's such a good question. You know, I mean, It's hard for me to say. I almost dare not dream it out loud, but I am so hopeful for the goodness of people. I think mm-hmm. that hasn't been emphasized enough these last few years. There's so much doom and there's so much anger and rage, and in many cases justifiably so, but I'm hopeful that people remember how to be kind to each other, how to be good to themselves, and tender and vulnerable with each other. And one way we can start to do that is to, again, remember our childhoods when we all, you know, when some of our first words when we spoke was the word, look, mama, look, dada, you know, look at the moon, look at that bird, look at that flower, you know, and it's hard to be full of rage when you are ecstatic over something that you notice, you know. But more than that, I think a lot of the writing that has been done about the outdoors has been mainly white, mainly male. And I think I'm kind of hopeful for a new future where different backgrounds and different abilities and different viewpoints of the outdoors are cherished and look to future generations so that it's not just one type of person's view of the outdoors. Like, I love Thoreau, I love John Muir, but boy, I would have loved to have read more women, more people mm-hmm. of color writing about the outdoors. And I think that just benefits everybody, not just brown folks, but white folks could stand to read about the outdoors written by people of color and different abilities, you know, and maybe to ask ourselves, why isn't there more, you know, why aren't there more disability narratives of people outside? What can we do to make the outdoors more accessible for people? You know, that kind of thing. So I'm hopeful that these questions are being asked, because when I, you know, and that's not that long ago, but in the 80s, they were, I mean, you could be raked over the coals for daring to ask about this, you know?
Right.
So I'm very hopeful, and I'm also very hopeful that there's a lot of people out there who want that change, who want the outdoors to be accessible for a whole range of people, that this isn't just a privileged class activity, right. You know, to go wandering outside. There's so many exciting organizations that bring kids from the inner city outside camping for an afternoon or for an evening, you know, and that stuff just wasn't around when I was little. So I'm very hopeful for the future.
I am one of the things that struck me reading this wonderful book is your love of and belief in Mississippi. There's a passage in which you speak of the tiny magnets in you that lined up and snapped to attention because you were finally where you needed to be. What, I mean, I don't know, how did the natural world tell you that? I mean, what signs did you receive from the natural world to beyond the magnets to tell you this is where you're supposed to be?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, on a very immediate level, you know, I spent 15 years just south of Buffalo, New York, where I was indoors most of the time. And I put my time in with the snow. And, you know, I mean, my toddlers would be buried up to their necks in snow. You know, we had those heavy lake effect snowfalls. And you know, that's not what drew me here. But when I first moved to Oxford, we were supposed to be here just for 9 months. Fellowship. And we thought, well, we'll have our Southern adventure and then go back to normal life. But we moved into Oxford on a 100-degree day in August. And there was something, I could hear bird song. I could smell the kudzu. I could be outside, even though it was hot. I just reveled in the relentless sunshine. I loved it. And even something like driving down Jackson Avenue, which is not the most beautifully aesthetically pleasing street, it just felt so lively. I also was relieved to be in a town where I wasn't the only brown person anymore. And I could feel myself unclench and I could take a deep exhale. I didn't have to be asked. I will also tell you this, that I was never asked if these boys that accompanied me were my own, you know, right. Where in Western New York, I was mistaken for the nanny a couple times just in the grocery store. And, you know, my husband is white. My kids are mixed. But that just doesn't happen here in the South. And specifically in Mississippi, nobody asks me, what are you? That question that has plagued me since I can remember. And you know, I don't know if it's a combination of manners or people have just talked about race relations here in a much more direct way than anywhere else in this country. But my sons also don't have to see me, you know, at the grocery store get asked, hey, excuse me, miss, what are you? You know, and they don't see me be othered. I can walk into a library or, you know, in the before times, walk into a restaurant and people don't just stare at me. You know, people don't just come up and ask, oh, we had a bet. We were wondering if you were Aztec or not, you know. And it sounds silly in some ways, but I can't tell you how much I feel at home just even from that. And to see my kids play with a Vietnamese kid, a Muslim kid, a Latino kid, and have crushes on the same, you know, where we didn't get that in Western New York, frankly. And so I know there's Oxford is not perfect and it has a long way to go, but I am very hopeful that this is a vibrant place that people want to do good and want to change for the better and to make it a place that people of all backgrounds can find a claim for home here as well. You know, I mean, I know there's people who, I don't know, it's a strange thing to say about Oxford, you know, but I believe in the goodness of the people. And I have hope that they'll come around the people who are set in their ways. I think they will see that, you know, I always want to say, join us, join the future. The future is a rainbow. You know, the future is, so good and vibrant. So I have hope that it'll come around.
It reminds me, you know, you're speaking very personally of the way you have embraced Mississippi and Mississippi has embraced you and your family. And it complements something I see and hear in the world of writing today, too. So many black and brown writers, you know, including, you know, a friend of ours, Kiese Lehman, you know, who are actively claiming the South, actively claiming Mississippi, which is important. It is both liberating for those who claim the state and the South. It's also liberating for white people like me, because, you know, if we all claim this place, then we can together make a better place. If we Absolutely. All dedicate ourselves to this place. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and I always say, like, I don't know. I don't look over my shoulder here in the way that I did in my small town in Western New York. And, you know, if I'm alone in a parking lot at night, you know, and, I don't know, I just feel like what the media tells us is, about Mississippi, about the South is not always positive. And some of that is, of course, justified.
Sure.
But I wish, and that's on me as well. I say this to my students all the time. I absolutely had a closed mind. When the first thing, you know, I heard when I was coming to Mississippi, I was like, oh, I'm a little nervous. I'm a little scared, you know? I found that to be just the opposite. I mean, my whole writing life's project has been searching for home, and I found it, and of all places, Mississippi. I don't think I could have ever predicted that, you know? Yeah. And so I think I just want to shout about it. I just want to shout that, you know, the kind of the backwards things you see on the media is one part, but it's just as backward in Western New York as it is, you know, in Mississippi, and, or it's in some parts of Mississippi. And I just, you know, I'm so happy to say that my mixed race family is a part of it too. You know, I'm so proud of that. I'm so, so proud of that for the future.
Well, I want to ask you, please, if you would read the opening of the Firefly piece.
Oh, sure.
It'd be a great pairing with the recollections about your family and the possibilities of the open air.
Yeah, you know, I wrote this a while ago, and when I was looking at this over again, I just got the book in my hand not too long ago, just a few days ago. But, you know, I haven't seen my folks since January. So it destroys me a little bit. Reading this in the summer is different, knowing that, you know, oh, usually in the summer, they're either here or my boys have been there several times already. And this is the first summer of my life where I haven't seen my folks. So it is. This book is also a good reminder for me to just, you know, to contemplate things and to slow down a little bit as well. But it does, there's parts that definitely make me a little sadder, to recollect these times together. So here we go. Here's Firefly. And the Latin name, I put the Latin name for all of these creatures and plants. The Latin name for the firefly is Photinus pyralis. When the first glimmer pop of firefly light appears on a summer night, I always want to call my mother just to say hello. The bibliography of the firefly is a tender and electric dress, a small flame sputtering in the ditches along a highway, and the elytra covering the hind wings of the firefly lift like a light leather, suppler than any other beetle's. In flight, it is like a loud laugh, the kind that only appears in summer, with the stink of meat sizzling somewhere down the street and the mouths of neighborhood children stained with popsicle juice and hinging open with the excitement of a ball game or tag.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
And talk of stink, of course, takes us straight to corpse flowers.
Yes. Good segue. Good segue.
I'm so intrigued by corpse flowers. I'd heard tell of them, but didn't understand much about them until I read your passage about them. Would you read a piece from there too? I'm thinking about the part where you begin to explore the plant's temperature.
Okay, great. I can't get over the plant's temperature. When you touch the spadix of a corpse flower, it feels almost human, full of blood, and you might expect to feel your hand pulse at its heartbeat. Just last week, I read how trees speak to each other underground, how they let out warnings of toxins or deforestation. Trees have also been known to form alliances and friendships through fungal networks. All of these findings are still new, but I'm in love with the idea that plants have a temperature, that they can run warm and cold when they need to, that they can send signals to species who will help them, not harm them. And what a magnificent telegraph we might send back, especially if other humans have ever made you feel alone on this earth.
Hmm. You use the word love here and your love for the corpse flower, but love also plays a role, a different kind of role in your relationship with the corpse flower and your husband.
That's right. It's kind of, I wish I, you know, you can't almost make this stuff up, but you know, really the, I mean, this is not the only reason why I ended up marrying my husband, but
of course,
one of the many is that he's really the one of the only men who was never put off or scared or frightened by my knowledge of the plant and animal world, and specifically about the corpse flower. I mean, you know, as one does over a dinner date, when we were dating really long distance, and you know, when the inevitable question of, so what have you been doing this week? Well, my answers were usually, you know, oh, I just came back from visiting this corpse flower or tracking this temperature on this corpse flower, you know. And, you know, it was an easy way to separate the wheat from the chaff. You know, you could tell about in an instant which guys were excited to hear about that or which guys' eyes started to glaze over who would not be interested at all. And Dustin's eyes always sparkled, and he not only sparkled but genuinely wanted to know, took it upon himself to track down other corpse flowers blooming for me across the country, you know. And so it is just, it's one, and you know, I write about this in the book, and we went tracking them together, you know. So it is very funny. That is not the only reason why I ended up marrying him, but it's because he just never flinched. And to this day, we're both writers. We both teach here at the University of Mississippi. And it is a lot for, I think, two writers in particular who write in the same genre even. It shouldn't be rare, but I think it's a rare thing to have, and especially when there's different ethnic backgrounds, to frankly have a white man say, hey, I want you to shine, and I'm going to do everything I can mm-hmm. for our family to make sure the kids are not running feral while you go off and do your reading here or visit this school. And now I'm not traveling, but he's still, I mean, we very much both, I hope he would be able to say the same for me, but I wouldn't have it any other way, where we're both the other person's biggest fan. And so that's just been such a big blessing in our lives, that we can say, hey, did you read this New Yorker article together, and disagree, and, you know, and have these really exciting conversations, and again, kind of not be bored and not need electricity. Mm. And, you know, he's just the greatest conversationalist. And, our early conversations were about the corpse flower.
Well, that's inspiring to me too, as I think about the future, because that's another kind of future, a different kind of gendered future in which, you know, you march off into the future together as peers, as curious peers, bringing home information and insights and making a life together. And that, for a fellow resident of Mississippi and Oxford, is a hopeful thing to know, and to for all of us.
Yeah, I hope so. And more than that too, now that I'm a mom who's raising two boys, I think it's so important that they see, you know, oh, daddy's, you know, doing everything he can to help mommy, and make sure mommy gets her art time or her writing time. And also, mommy's also doing everything she can to make sure daddy is feeling okay and getting some writing time in. And that is absolutely, no matter if my boys end up with a partner or not, I want them to see that that's how you be someone's good friend and a life partner, is that you help each other out. And it's, you know, and anyway, so I just think that. I hope, I fail many times, but I hope ultimately that's what they come away with, is that mom and daddy were a team on the years that they publish and the years where nothing is coming, you know, but no matter what, we were a team.
Well, as a resident of Oxford and a believer in Oxford and a believer in the the literary future of Oxford. We're so happy to have y'all as a part of this conversation, and I'm so pleased to have had the chance to spend time with you today talking about your beautiful book, The World of Wonders, and about the futures that one can glimpse by reading that book. So thank you, Amy, so much.
Thank you. This was so fun. Thank you.
Matt Pearl produced this episode.
And we thank Wendell Patrick for Gravy's theme music and Jazar for our donor music. And managing editor for Gravy and other SFA media, all other SFA media, Sarah Kent Milam. We thank her.
Mary Beth Lassiter serves as our publisher. Visit SFA at southernfoodways.org to watch our Ruth Fertel Keeper of the Flame film about the life and work of Hanan Shabazz,
the pride of Asheville, North Carolina. While you're there, please consider making a donation to the SFA or becoming a member if you're not already a member. Your dollars help us make Gravy. They fund our work, and we need them. We want them. We thank you for those dollars.
I'm Melissa Hall.
I'm John T. Edge.
Thanks for letting us pour some gravy in your ear.
Gurgle, gurgle, gurgle.